tuned to Tidings, and I'm Hazel Kahn. I'm very pleased today to introduce you to Jim Sturber, author of the recently published Nature Wars, the incredible story of how wildlife comebacks turned backyards into battlegrounds. An incredible story indeed, meticulously told with numbers and facts, some of them so inconceivable that at times, honestly, I felt I was reading fiction or the backstory for a dystopian movie. So welcome to Tidings, Jim. I'm very much looking forward to our conversation.
Me too, Hazel.
I first heard about your book a few months ago at a public meeting in Southold, where I live on the east end of Long Island. A record crowd had assembled there to listen to experts, both local and from other parts of the country, talking about our deer problem, which has gone basically from being an inconvenience to a nuisance to what is now, I think, fairly freely labeled as a plague. After reading Nature Wars, I understand our deer invasion in a much broader context, both historical and contemporary. So I can now see the inevitability of our plague in Southold. It's inevitable, the way you tell the story. So, Jim, could you begin with the story of what you refer to as man, beast, and tree, that you say has happened very quickly in historical terms?
Well, in a nutshell, Hazel, three things happened. The first was that around 150 years ago or so, the forests that we had cut down over the previous 300 years began to come back. And they began to come back in the Northeast on abandoned cropland. Remember when the Erie Canal opened in 1825 and the Ohio Valley opened up all that fertile land out there? Farmers in the Northeast and New England began to give up their marginal land, hillsides, too many rocks, and so on. And trees took it back. It doesn't take very long for trees to come back on an untended piece of landscape. The second thing that happened is after killing off all these wild creatures for almost four centuries, the conservation movement at the end of the 19th century was started. And the last half of the 19th century was called the era of extermination. It was so egregious. I mean, commercial hunters killed everything that had a value for feathers, fur, meat, and so on.
Was it called the era of extermination at the time?
No, I think later
post-talk,
on.
Post-talk, yeah.
Remember, this is when the buffalo were all killed off, mm-hmm. and we were pushing west. Immigrants were pouring in. There was a need for a lot of cheap protein, and people had been hunting, commercial hunting, since we got here, and trapping. You know, the first currencies were beaver pelts and deer hides. Those two commodities actually paid for the cost of the ships to come over here and explore. Anyway, the conservation movement kicked in when people began to realize that we could actually run out of both wildlife and trees. And that was around the end of the 19th century. Then the third thing that happened was after the Second World War, when there was a terrific housing shortage for all the returning veterans, Leavitt towns were built on the edges of cities. And then people just kept moving further and further out on better roads, driving affordable cars, burning cheap gas. And by about 1960, we were about, I think, a third rural, a third urban, and a third suburban. By the 2000 census, an absolute majority of the American population lived not in cities nor on working farms, but in this vast in-between I call sprawl, suburban, exurban, rural sprawl. That was land that was occupied by small family farms a century ago, and those farmers did a pretty good job of stewardship of their landscape. It's now full of people, it's full of forests, and it's increasingly full of wild creatures that we brought back so successfully that we now fight over what to do or what not to do about too much of a good thing.
A prevailing theme that you point out in our culture is this feeling of loss and irreversibility caused by human destruction. We'll never walk this way again. The species are gone forever. The trees have been cut. The wetlands are disappearing. The concrete is everywhere. But what you say is that the narrative of loss is misplaced, that really what we are facing is too much of a good thing, what one might refer to perhaps as the rich man's burden or the plight of the first world, just too much of a good thing.
What I meant by that is in our little corner of the planet, we have wealth that much of the world would envy, wealth of flora and fauna, wild birds and animals and trees, and that, you know, the rest of the world may be going to hell in a handbasket, and it's partly our fault. For example, in the Northeast, we get very few of our own forest products from our own forests. We get our 2x4s from tree farms and from the boreal forests of Canada. We get our furniture from tropical rainforest timber cut in places like Borneo. And we think that cutting a tree to make use of, you know, it's a renewable resource after all, and the Northeast is a great place to grow trees. We're against cutting trees for all sorts of reasons. I mean, cutting trees is a real no-no among most of the people I know. But that ideology does not fit with our use of forest product. Those products have to come from somewhere, and they come from trees somewhere. And in many cases, they come from places that have weaker environmental laws, more corruption, a more fragile soil, like Borneo, the tropical rainforest of Borneo. So that's what I mean. The narrative of loss is the idea that started a long time ago, way back before George Perkins Marsh and Henry David Thoreau, that the world is going to hell and it's our fault. And that's true, or it may be true, or it may be half true, but it is certainly not all true, and it's really not true talking about our forests.
Because our forests have come back.
Absolutely. 60% of the land that people think was forested in the year 1600 in the eastern third of the United States is reforested today. And that's 80% in New England. Connecticut, for example, is 60% forested, and it's even more forested if you didn't use the official U.S. Forest Service definition, which is very complicated. I won't go into it, but a lot of people in Connecticut live under a lot of trees, but because they mow the lawns or tend bushes under those trees, they can't be counted as official forest. So a whole lot more of Connecticut's actually forested. In fact, John Gordon, as I say in the book, the former dean of the Yale Forestry School, used to say that if you look down on Connecticut in the summer, you would see almost all unbroken forest. If you look down at the same area in the late fall after the leaves have fallen from those trees, what you'd see is stockbrokers.
Okay, but to go back to the loss narrative, one of the things that really astounded me in your book is just the sheer numbers that you mentioned. You know, there's the story and the loss and the lamentation of the species we're losing and the species that are going extinct. Yet what you talk about, that in fact we have far too many animals. Maybe they're the wrong ones. Maybe animals are not well enough distributed anymore. But you talk about things like, you said hunters and other predators kill 12 million deer each fall. You say there's 25,000 wild geese in the New York metro area, that there's 60 to 90 million feral cats who are said to kill 500 million birds each year in the United States. And then you talk about roadkill and the numbers surrounding that. So this is another place where there's too much.
There may be too many deer in the suburbs to sustain the habitat in which they live. But this is a people problem. This isn't an animal problem. Southold has, and I've just been getting emails from friends who are worried about that problem, and they're up to 200 deer per square mile. In a normal, rural, unpeopled area, there should be maybe 10 to 15 deer per square mile. So the sprawl can hold a lot more deer than can an unpeopled forest. And then take an animal like Canada geese, these grassy places that we create for ourselves or for our kids to play soccer on or for people to play golf on and so on, are just wonderful habitats for resident Canada geese. And they multiply, their mortality rate are a lot less than migrating geese. Feral cats, you know, we make it far too easy in this country to throw cats away. And as a result, we've got this enormous feral cat problem, which a lot of people don't think is a problem, unless, you know, they happen to be bird-loving people, in which they do think it's a terrible problem. You know, beavers now have, by some estimates, are causing more damage to infrastructure than almost any other wild creature out there. Columbia, South Carolina, hired a guy a couple of years ago for $1 million, these are taxpayer dollars, to clean out the beavers in their sewer systems and their drainage systems and so on. So, but, you know, these are problems we created, and I don't know if there are too many of them or too many of us. If we like them, if we like them to be around, and if we understand the need to sort of balance the habitat, I don't see any reason why we shouldn't keep them around. We certainly shouldn't kill off a whole bunch of them unless that's required to balance the landscape for the good of plants, animals, and people. I like seeing deer up in Dutchess County in New York where we go on weekends. I also like to hunt them. I like to eat them. But sometimes the farmer next door gets a depredation permit from the New York Department of Conservation to kill them off around his place because they're damaging his crops.
Right. But the point is, whether we like them or not, what we've done to make our own habitats so inviting and hospitable to wildlife.
We put out lots of food in the form of grass for many species. Geese eat grass, deer eat grass, a lot of other creatures do too. We put out bird seed. Bears love bird seed along with birds and squirrels and other things. We put out mulch and garbage. We have all kinds of food in our dumpsters. If those dumpsters aren't secure and you happen to find yourself in one at 3 o'clock in the morning, there's a pretty good chance you're not going to be alone. You're going to be sharing it with all sorts of opossums, raccoons, cats, and all sorts of things that have found their way into those dumpsters. So we put out a lot of food. We create shelter. Birdseed, I mean, we put out 500,000 tons of birdseed a year. This is food that wouldn't be there if we didn't put it out. You know, bears love birdseed. They love everything. They love anything that will fill them up. You know, bears are increasing in numbers. One of the key things that we provide is protection. We kill a lot of creatures with our cars, but we provide protection from predation. Here's one story that I tell, which I think illustrates, especially in the case of Southold deer, for example. It's been suggested through research that the biggest predator of white-tailed deer since the end of the last ice age has been man. The research suggests that man killed more white-tailed deer than all other predators combined. The two chief other predators are wolves and mountain lions, but that man throughout this long history has always killed more. So what happens in the sprawl? In the last three decades or so, essentially man has gotten out of the predation business. He doesn't hunt much, and he doesn't like other people to hunt on his property. He's legislated all sorts of restrictions on the use of firearms for safety reasons. Remember, the white-tailed deer's historic range is in the eastern United States. You can't go much higher into Canada before you get into conifer forests, which are not really deer-friendly. So the white-tailed's historic range has been in the eastern third of the United States. Deciduous forests, where three-quarters of our original forests were, not counting Alaska's. So what's happened in the heart of the whitetail's historic range is that just in the last few decades, huge swaths of that historic range has been made off-limits to its deer's biggest predator. I mean, that's an astonishing thing. For 11,000 years, we were the biggest predator, and for the last 30 years, we suddenly aren't that predator. So as a result, you have these enormous populations of deer in the sprawl. I mean, there are all sorts of places where there are 60, 80, 100 more than, and in Southold, 200 deer per square mile.
This is Hazel Kahn. I'm talking with Jim Sturber, author of Nature Wars, the incredible story of how wildlife comebacks turned backyards into battlegrounds. So that brings me to the question of carrying capacity. I mean, you said that's not the right amount, 200. Somehow there's a right amount, right? And there is such a thing as carrying capacity, so that if one were to try and make the whole thing more balanced, there would be metrics maybe that could be used.
People use these arguments. They say, well, you know, you should only have in an unpeopled area 10 to 15 deer per square mile is about right. If you get above 20, they're starting to damage their habitat, and they're starting to degrade their habitat. So the biological carrying capacity of that unpeopled area might have been reached for white-tailed deer. They start to eat out the understory of forests, and that hurts the birds that live there, that hurts the insects and plants that live there. And remember, birds feed their young insects. They don't feed them seeds. So if you haven't got caterpillars and other things running around in the understory, the birds there are threatened. Look at the sprawl. You've got this habitat that is so enhanced. It's so subsidized with what we grow. And remember, a lot of the stuff that we grow to look. We don't eat it. We mow it and throw it away. We leave it out there to look at. And this habitat can hold a whole lot more deer than a normal unpeopled area. Same way with something like raccoons. Part of my book about raccoons in around Orlando. The Ocala National Forest is about 60 miles north of Orlando. And the biologist there told me that maybe 10 raccoons per square mile, maybe 20, you know, it varies depending on what's there, is about right. But beyond that, you're going to have problems. In Orlando, because there's so much food and so many hiding places and so much other stuff, you can have 10 times that many raccoons. A guy who runs the critter control franchise in Orlando told me, he said, you know, in the Ocala National Forest, a raccoon lives in a hole in a tree. In Orlando, I live in a hole in a tree, except my tree's been cut into boards and turned into a house. And instead of one hole in one tree, my house is porous. There are 20 or 30 holes that a raccoon, a squirrel, and everything else can get into. And there's the drip pan under my air conditioner is a water source for them. My garbage is out there. I mean, so the densities of these creatures can be far greater in sprawl than they can be out in a normal, unpeopled habitat.
The thing about this is that it's the war with the wildlife is one thing, but we're also at war with each other in a sense, whether you're an environmentalist as opposed to a conservationist. You point out also that urban people are more likely to think one way than rural people about such things. Farmers think differently than homeowners would. This all devolves around to what is the role of human oversight? How much of nature is actually our business? Should we leave nature alone or should we manage it? So maybe you could you just talk a little about that? Because it's created all kinds of arguments and discussions already between me and my friends. We always were birds of a feather flocking together, as it were. You know, and now it seems that we are really starting to be on opposite sides of this argument.
Well, it goes back way, 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 way back, this notion of whether we're part of nature, whether we're overlords of nature. Remember when the pilgrims came, William Bradford looked out over a howling wilderness full of wild beasts and wild men that the pilgrims had been sent by God to tame. And, you know, over the next 400 years, we tamed it all right. We ruined it. We practically destroyed it. And then the conservation movement came along. It put an end to the bad practices, began to restore. Forests were growing back because we didn't need all that farmland to grow our food. And so we've been in the nature management business for a long time. And there are some myths. For example, around the first Earth Day in 1970 and afterwards, there were a whole spate of new books. One of them was about the ecological Indian and how Indians, Native Americans, were just one other species on the landscape. They lived in harmony with one another and the creatures and so on. Well, that myth has been pretty much exploded in recent decades by scholars who talked about how Indians managed. They farmed their forests, essentially. They burned out understories to enhance growth of things they needed to live, to eat, and to wear, for example, to create berries and mass crops or nuts and so on. So they managed the forests. And then we're out in the sprawl. Remember, a majority of us live out there. Mm-hmm. And we're managing nature like crazy, whether we know it or not, for good or for bad, with all these things we do. And to say that we need to leave it alone, that nature will balance itself, that nature provides. The one constant that scientists say happens in a natural landscape is change. Change is constant. Every now and then, even if you have the most pristine, unpeopled landscape, a fire is going to come through, a flood, a tsunami, a tornado, and it's going to rearrange that landscape. And of course, we're great landscape rearrangers. We're out there in big numbers. We have, by our management or lack of management, we've managed to create enhanced habitats that make all of these creatures, the ones that are damaging to us and the ones that are simply nuisances, thrive. I mean, what I say in the book is that my bottom line in talks is that we're better stewards of our forests than our white-tailed deer. And I think we have an obligation to manage those forests and to manage the habitat and to manage the landscape for the good of plants, animals, and people, and not just favor one species or another. I say in the book that we've turned into a bunch of species partisans. Pick your creature, feral cat, a deer, a beaver, whatever, and save it, and not think about the total habitat that we all share, and we as an apex predator and as a keystone species have an obligation to manage, because I think we're better at it than things that are out there managing it for their own without knowing it.
When you say manage, I thought you were actually also meaning something else, that we've unintentionally managed sprawl. So we're managing nature, but unintentionally. It's not really management. We're just doing what we want to do.
We're managing it intentionally or unintentionally, whether we know it or not.
Right.
I go to the American Pet Products Association Pet Expo every other year or so, and there are all sorts of companies that do this now that will create habitat to bring in wildlife. And, of course, what people think they want to bring in is stuff like cardinals, butterflies, you know, bunnies maybe, frogs.
Hummingbirds.
Hummingbirds and so on. But what happens when the skunk turns up at this garden party? Well, there's a whole other booming industry in nuisance wildlife control. So here you have two booming industries encouraging us to spend money, one to spend money to bring wildlife in and the other on call to take nuisance wildlife out. And they're both in the nature wildlife management business. And we are the reason that they're booming.
The fact is that people don't want to kill these animals because we have this built-in Bambi complex, not just about the deer, but about everything, that nature's lovely and animals are cute, and your whole thesis about being denatured. You yourself grew up as a farm boy, right, in Michigan. So you grew up with nature, in nature. The idea of actually more active management, specifically to keep the numbers more in proportion or in balance or in line with the carrying capacity of the environment, How does that relate to this, what you call denatured, that we've become?
I think what you're asking is how do we rationalize our behavior?
Mm-hmm.
And you're right. I think a lot of people think that a lethal option for managing these creatures is just not right, that they have learned to associate these creatures as backyard guests or outdoor pets. This goes back to the 19th century. When forests were at a historic low, wildlife was at a historic low, and suddenly wilderness became really popular because there was so little of it left and it was way over the horizon. And a business called excursionism came along to take people to wilderness areas so they could see what was left of the pristine landscape. At around the same time, authors like Jack London and William Long began writing best-selling books about wild creatures. They began anthropomorphizing these creatures. And then comes 1920, 22 or 30, Walt Disney's Bambi came along. And it was full of anthropomorphized creatures living together in a forest. And man is the only bad guy. And the lesson is that when man messes with nature, nature loses. And then you can fast forward to Disney's True Life Adventure series, where Seal Island in 1948, I think, won an Academy Award. And it's all about these seals living together on an island. No people, but when the female seals come in to the tune of Here Comes the Bride, and Variety magazine said, Disney is teaching people to be peeping Tom naturalists. And nice family seal life was portrayed. For example, bull seals trampling puppies to death were edited out. And so nature was this benign creation in our minds. And we lost track at the same time. I mean, we moved indoors. We spend 90% of our time indoors in our houses, offices, and cars these days. The closest we get to nature is to look out our window at our bird feeder. I mean, that's not universally true. Lots of people know lots of stuff about nature, and even those people don't like to use lethal means to control or to rebalance. And because we've made mistakes by killing off too many things in the past, who's to say, these people say, that we won't do it again?
Mm.
And, you know, I'm optimistic. We've learned from our mistakes. But we're so used to saving creatures, to saving wildlife, saving wild birds, bringing them back, that when this new paradigm arrives, when we've got too many, or the damage or nuisance value creates a tipping point, it outweighs the good views that we've had of them. When that happens, we tend to start demonizing these creatures, and we tend to start fighting about what to do and what not to do about them.
You say you're optimistic. Could we maybe end with you talking about how you do see the future? I mean, I have this very detailed picture of sprawl in my head. How do you undo it?
The main problem is a lack of education about wildlife and the wild landscape and the creatures that inhabit it. I mean, we need to learn what wildlife biologists have been telling us forever, which is that you don't feed wildlife. We've designed our whole road system so that doing something about roadkill is pretty difficult, if not impossible. We've had all these hunting restrictions, for example, in our suburbs and exurbs, firearms, discharges, and so on. The hunters turn out to be relatively safe. Guns are terrible. They kill 31,000 people a year in this country. Hunters kill about 100.
Jim, what do we do about our backyards then? Do we stop having backyards?
No, you can. I mean, there are all sorts of things people do to keep their, that build high fences. You know, there's some parts of Long Island that look like POW camps. There are all sorts of products out there.
No, but more radically than that is the actual just not planting things there in the first place.
We build these things because we like them. And, mm-hmm. I mean, we like living out there. We like growing this stuff. We like creating this stuff. And many of us like having wild creatures around. And there's nothing wrong with that as long as you're not disturbed by it. Most communities have a problem of one sort or another. Mm-hmm. They just don't know that there are 1,000 communities or 10,000 with the same problem. And they all start, as I say in my talks, they all start at year zero. And year zero is, gee, maybe we have a deer problem here. Do you think we have a deer problem? They start talking about it. And then they start arguing about it. No, we don't have a deer problem. Yes, we do have a deer problem. And in most deer fights, I noticed, in many cases that I know of, 10 years to get to the point, this tipping point that I mentioned, where people say, okay, we've got to do something. We've gone through all the options, lethal and non-lethal, and we've decided that we have to cull some deer. Then they start fighting about who's going to cull the deer. Do we get local bow hunters to come in and try it? Do we get hire sharpshooters at taxpayer expenses? Do we let hunters come in? How many, where, and so on. And this battle goes on.
So, Jim, can you also tell people what website they should visit if they want to know more about this?
If you go to www.jimsterba.com, you'll find all sorts of book reviews, radio and television interviews. Nature Wars was a finalist at the Los Angeles Times Book Prizes. Citations are there and synopsis and so on. So that's a good place to start.
Thank you very much for talking to us. Thank you very much, Jim.
Well, it's been a pleasure. I had a great time. Thank you.
Thank you very much. That was Jim Sterba, author of Nature Wars, talking about how we came to do battle with wildlife invading our backyards and with each other about restoring balance. Tidings from Hazel Khan is heard on the second Wednesday of the month at 7:30 p.m. on WPKN 89.5 FM Bridgeport, streaming on WPKN.org and archived on hazelkahn.com. Tidings is produced by Tony Ernst.